Okay, so we spent several weeks talking about the first four commandments, where God especially tells his people, the people of Israel, the obligations that they have particularly toward him in worship and not making other, not worshiping idols or making graven images and not taking his name in vain and remembering the Sabbath to keep it holy. Those were the first four commandments. Now, in commandments 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, God establishes fundamental principles for human society. And if these are established, then society works well. If these are ignored, society disintegrates. And the first principle in human society, honor your father and mother, establishes authority in the family, and then it has implications for authority in other areas of life as well. The sixth commandment, you shall not murder, protects life. Seventh commandment, you shall not commit adultery, protects marriage. The eighth commandment, you shall not steal, protects property. The ninth commandment, you shall not bear false witness, protects truth. And the tenth commandment, you shall not covet, protects purity of heart. If those things are protected in a culture or a society or a church, then life functions quite well. But if these are not protected and the enemy attacks these and begins to undermine these, and we see that happening in our many parts of society today, where the enemy tries to undermine legitimate authority and promotes the taking of life through abortion, euthanasia, destruction of marriage through sexual immorality, destruction of property through theft, but also excessive government confiscation of property. Truth, where people are accustomed to lying and lie regularly and routinely through the day, that those things begin to undermine a society. So these commandments that we're talking about are really important. They're crucial for the proper functioning of society. So now, last week we began with commandment 5, honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land that your Lord your God is giving you. And we talked about the responsibility of children to obey their parents. And we focused on children's responsibility last week, including adult children and adult parents. But now I want to look at the responsibilities of parents to discipline their children. So that's point B on the outline, which is at the top of the page now that Clyde and Elaine have photocopied and handed out. Application to parents, Ephesians 6:4. Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. This commandment, again, teaches parents, fathers, but also by implication mothers, to discipline their children, and it has a huge implication for society. I was reading just in the Wall Street Journal a couple of weeks ago, a professor was standing at a bus stop in England, and there were some kids standing there, and a 13-year-old boy threw some food at another kid, and it missed, and it landed on the sidewalk, and the professor turned to the 13-year-old kid and said, well, aren't you going to pick that up? And the kid just started swearing and let out a huge string of unprintable words at this professor, and you know, there wasn't anything that could be done. But what kind of society is that, where that just happens again and again and again, where children are out of control, not disciplined, and not respectful of older people in general, of adults in general, or of authority at all? That leads to the disintegration of society. So it's important that parents rightly discipline their children. And under discipline, number one, point A is that parents, especially fathers, are responsible for having their children under control, for having them be respectful and obedient. 1 Timothy 3:4 says a qualification for an elder is this: he must manage his own household well, with all dignity, keeping his children submissive. For if someone does not know how to manage his own household, how will he care for God's church? When Margaret and I lived in another state, at two different times, at two different churches, when I was a member of an elder board at a church, a candidate's name came up for nomination to the elder board, and two different times I remember that candidate was turned down because the conversation among the elders was, his children are out of control. And you can see, even in how they act when they're in the church on Sunday, that they're not obedient, they're not well-disciplined. And if he can't manage his own household well, how can he be an elder in God's church? And whereas the man in both cases was otherwise qualified with what appeared to be, you know, a commitment to the Lord, a commitment to the work of the church and spiritual maturity, his children weren't disciplined and he was responsible. And we said, no, we can't nominate him for an elder because he'd failed in this crucial regard. He must manage his own household well, with all dignity, keeping his children submissive. For if someone does not know how to manage his own household, how will he care for God's church? Now, I should say, I also know an instance where a seminary professor, not at Phoenix Seminary, but at another seminary, had an adult child who had rejected the Lord and had married a Jewish man. And he went through some time of thinking whether this would disqualify him because his daughter basically had abandoned the faith. And I think his conclusion and the conclusion of others was, once the daughter had reached adulthood, he was no longer responsible for her conduct, and that was her own decision, and it was tragic and something that people prayed about. But it did not disqualify him from the eldership because she would no longer be thought of as children in the 1 Timothy 3:4 sense that people would have understood the word children to mean children living at home with their parents and under the age where they would be thought of as adults in 1 Timothy 3:4. Incidentally, I'm going to say, no, I'll have another story about that. But I did want to say that it was nice to open the bulletin this morning and see Ed Grant's picture and name being nominated as an elder, and I would encourage you to vote for Ed. Not that it's a competitive election, but still. And Barry Asmus, who teaches here as substitute, is also nominated for elder, so I was glad to see that. Discipline of children can take a variety of forms depending on the circumstances and depending on the child. Why? Because God himself, as a wise parent, disciplines us in various ways. And Paul Wegner, who teaches another class here at Scottsdale Bible, and although he's now going to move to California and take another job, but he and Kathy have a book called Wise Parenting from the Book of Proverbs. And he emphasizes that if you look through all of Proverbs, sometimes it's just a word of rebuke, and sometimes it's other kinds of discipline. It isn't always spanking, but various kinds of discipline are appropriate to the different circumstances of a child's life. Point C, discipline must never be cruel. But the Bible is clear that it will at times include physical discipline, spanking, or what in the UK what they call smacking. Several verses state that. Proverbs 13:24, whoever spares the rod hates his son, but he who loves him is diligent to discipline him. The rod was a stick, a piece of wood. Margaret and I, when our kids were growing up, had a wooden spoon that we used, and that was, we used it maybe not very often, but sometimes where there were cases of just willful, outright, blatant disobedience, or willful lying, or just meanness that wasn't really appropriate at all, where it was something we thought was a very serious kind of misbehavior, then we would discipline by spanking with a wooden spoon. And oftentimes, I would do that, sometimes, with tears in my eyes, but remembering this verse, whoever spares the rod hates his son. I did not hate my son. I loved my son. And then it says, he who loves him is diligent to discipline him. Proverbs 22:15, folly is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod of discipline drives it far from him. It's interesting that Proverbs 22:15 seems to understand that discipline, physical punishment, when it's appropriate and when it's done without cruelty, it actually teaches children. It drives foolishness from their heart. It has a teaching function. It's part of the teaching work of parents with regard to their children.
Proverbs 23:13, do not withhold discipline from a child. If you strike him with a rod, he will not die. If you strike him with the rod, you will save his soul from Sheol. And Proverbs 29:15, the rod and reproof give wisdom. So the rod is the spanking. Reproof is the word of counsel, or just a word of rebuke, or saying, no, Johnny, don't do that. Both give wisdom. But a child left to himself, that's an undisciplined child, a child left to himself brings shame to his mother. And then verse 17, discipline your son, and he will give you rest. He will give delight to your heart. How many times in a restaurant or a grocery store I've seen a parent with an out-of-control child, can't be disciplined, screaming, yelling, running, and being disruptive and bumping into people. And the mom is just at her wit's end, and she looks like she's tired out. And I just want to say, Proverbs 29:17. Discipline your son, and he will give you rest. Don't you want rest? Aren't you tired of this endless struggle? One whack on the bottom with a wooden spoon is worth 13 hours of conversation and persuasion for a young child. Discipline your son, and he will give you rest. If parents are just frazzled, bedraggled, worn out from their kids, it's probably one factor is a lack of discipline. The kids are in charge of the house instead of the parents being in charge of the house. And when kids are in charge of the house, it's just chaos and there's no peace. Discipline your son and he will give you rest. He will give delight to your heart. Proverbs 29:15. Hebrews 12:5-11 is also appropriate here because it compares God's discipline of us to an earthly father's discipline and says, have you forgotten the exhortation that addresses you as sons? My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor be weary when reproved by him. For the Lord disciplines the one he loves and chastises every son whom he receives. It is for discipline that you have to endure. God is treating you as sons. And see, when there's discipline in a Christian's life, the author of Hebrews says it's evidence of God's love for you. He cares for you. He wants your life to be better and to go well. And for that reason, he disciplines you. He's treating you as a son. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? Apparently, the author of Hebrews hadn't noticed some of the types of absence of discipline that are common in our culture. I don't know. If you are left without discipline in which all have participated, then you're the illegitimate children and not sons. Besides this, we've had earthly fathers who disciplined us and we respected them. Shall we not much more be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time as seemed best to them, but he disciplines us for our good, that we may share his holiness. For the moment all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. So we need to discipline in love, following God's pattern. But, see Proverbs 13:24, which I've quoted above, remember, whoever spares the rod hates his son, but he who loves him is diligent to discipline him. However, I've got to say this. Many times, and this varies from circumstance to circumstance, and it varies from child to child, many times only a word is necessary, not any physical discipline. Proverbs 17:10, a rebuke goes deeper into a man of understanding than 100 blows into a fool. And maybe you've known that too, that maybe one or maybe all of your children were sensitive to rebuke from their parents. And many times, and by and large with our children, that was the normal thing, where we just a word of correction and they would listen, it would be enough. Not always for sure, but many times. And many times only a word is necessary. Now, having said that, I've got to also add that maybe you're aware that some parts of modern culture strongly oppose any physical discipline or corporal punishment of children. And to the extent that societies lose Christian influence on the culture, they lose this biblical understanding of discipline many, many times. And I just want to read you a list of countries where laws now prohibit parents from spanking their children, prohibit corporal punishment. Corporal meaning having to do with your body. It's against the law to spank your children in Australia, Sweden, Norway, Finland, Austria, Cyprus, Denmark, Latvia, Croatia, Bulgaria, Germany, Iceland, Romania, Ukraine, Hungary, and Israel, sadly. They've all outlawed spanking of children or corporal punishment. Wow. Now what do you do? Fortunately, that hasn't happened in the United States yet. But there have been proposals for spanking bans in, where would you guess? Massachusetts and California. But those proposals have not been passed in their legislatures. What would you do if you lived in a country where spanking was prohibited? Well, he who spares the rod hates his son, but he who loves him is diligent to discipline him. I think, as a Christian, and I think as a pastor, I would counsel Christians that they still have a responsibility to administer physical discipline to their children and disobey the law, because God's law says don't. God's law says do this, and the law of man says don't do this, and there's a conflict. And I think when the laws of man command us to disobey God's laws, then we shouldn't obey the laws of man. I suppose I would counsel Christians to do this in the privacy of their home, not in the supermarket, where they're just going to bring attention to themselves. And, of course, that this kind of discipline should never be done in a way that brings actual physical harm to the child and bruising and is abusive. But, see, all states already have laws against that. They already have laws preventing harmful physical abuse by parents. And it's right, of course, that we have laws preventing a distortion of this teaching, and it's right that we have laws preventing kind of physical abuse that would actually bring harm to a child rather than just inflict a temporary stinging pain. The assumption of this anti-spanking campaign, the assumption is that human beings are essentially good by nature. And so they don't really agree with Proverbs 22:15 that I quoted above. Folly or foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. They think children are just born as wonderful, sweet, little innocent nothings, and little Johnny and Sally, it really isn't anything bad in them. It's just they just didn't understand clearly enough what they were supposed to do. So there's an assumption that human beings are essentially good and evil, good by nature. My response is, the Bible teaches that there is evil in the world, and some of that evil can only be restrained by force. That's the reason we have armies. That's the reason we have police forces. But with children, Proverbs 22:15 says, folly is bound up in their heart. There's an element of foolishness. No matter how nice and wonderful your children are, sometimes that foolishness is going to creep out and needs to be disciplined. The anti-spanking campaign, underneath it all, is an attempt to undermine all use of authority, which would cause society to have total breakdown. And it attempts to undermine God's plan for the family. And the way they do this is only by portraying abuses and distortions of biblical standards. In my book, Politics According to the Bible, on pages 256 and 257, I have some summaries of studies, sociological studies that have been done about the effectiveness of spanking. And what it says is that dozens and dozens of these studies just lump together wise,
thoughtful, restrained discipline with really abusive discipline and distortions of the teaching, and lump them all together and don't really distinguish between the two, and so they come out with distorted results, or they have incorrect sampling, or they're flawed, and so that there really aren't any sociological studies that show negative consequences definitively from physical discipline. My guess is if the studies were set up correctly, they would show overwhelmingly that children who were spanked with restraint and wisdom and love turn out a lot better in society. I'm tempted to ask.
Well, I had an answer. Take away the computer and phone.
Okay, Jack has another thought. Well, look, you do not have... I don't like it when people ask questions and everybody has to hold up their hand. So if you don't want to hold up your hand, you don't have to. But how many of you were spanked when you were growing up as a child? So I say that's all about 100%. Okay.
You can't remember.
E.G. can't remember. I go on to point two. Ephesians 6:4 says, "Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger." If discipline is overly harsh and overly demanding, then of course it does provoke an anger in children because they think they can never live up no matter how hard they are trying. But the other thing that will provoke their children to anger is no discipline. And I heard a nationally recognized Christian speaker who was a very successful collegiate football player on a championship team say once, and he was in Christian ministry at this point, he said he was brought up with no discipline at all in his home, and it made him so angry. And he remembered one time he was doing some construction work as a teenager, doing some construction work, and his parents always just had refused ever to take any discipline. He was so angry at the lack of discipline that he just, in anger, threw a hammer across the room. Didn't hit anybody or anything, but it was just an expression of his frustration, his anger, that his parents would never take a stand and define right and wrong for him. Now, Christ came into his life and has made a tremendous difference, but he recognized even later and felt strongly how neglected he felt by having parents who didn't discipline him or didn't draw any lines at all. That's another way to provoke your children to anger, Ephesians 6:4. Don't do that, the Bible says. But bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. That means instruction as well, not just discipline. Teach them about God and His ways, Deuteronomy 6. The commands of Moses for the people of Israel are also appropriate for us. Talking about the words of God that Moses had given to the people, he said, "These words that I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise." That's a command to parents to talk about God's principles and God's ways with their children. And Proverbs 1:8, "Hear, my son, your father's instruction. Forsake not your mother's teaching." That's a frequent theme in the book of Proverbs. To bring them up in the instruction of the Lord means you have to understand them, their unique gifts, their differences, their interests. And I just think back on our kids growing up. They were so different. They had different things they were interested in. They were better or worse at sports, and better or worse at school, and better or worse. They just differed in their abilities to get along with people and to do athletic things, to do artistic things, to do academic things. They were just different. We had to care for their needs and show love to them. I would say also, point E, that parents teach by example as much as by words. Now, I know this is not exactly addressed to parents in Titus 2:7. It's Paul talking to Titus as a leader in the church. But I think it has implications for how parents should live as well. Show yourself in all respects, Titus 2:7, to be a model, a tupos in Greek, a model of good works. That is, someone who is imitated. And 1 Peter 5:3, elders are not to be domineering over those in their charge, but being examples to the flock. So parents teach by how they live as much as by what they speak. Parenting requires much wisdom from God, James 1:5-8, where James says we should ask God when we don't know what to do, and we're puzzled and we're stumped. Lord, what should I do about this situation with my kids? If anyone lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives to all generously and without reproach, and it will be given to him, says James 1. Now, point G. See, now, when I was fresh out of seminary and started to do Bible teaching in churches, I thought, well, how can I teach on raising children? Because, after I finished my doctoral work, I had one child who was 3 and one who was a newborn. Well, I thought, maybe I don't have any right to teach on how to raise children because I haven't done it yet, except for 3 years, which you can't really tell much by 3 years. But I thought, well, it's God's Word, so I'll do the best I can and teach what God's Word says. Now, and then I thought, maybe when you get to be 50, you have a right to teach on how to raise children. See, but now, so now Margaret and I have children that are 32, 35, and 38. And now you look back and you think, oh no, Lord, I see mistakes that I've made. Do you ever think that? Oh yeah, okay. So what if we have made mistakes? And look, we love our kids. We're proud of our kids. I think our kids are really happy with what God is doing in their lives. But we make mistakes, and some of those mistakes come back to us again and again. Just where we were too harsh, too strict, or too lenient in one place or another, demanded too much, didn't demand enough, didn't help enough as we could have, or helped too much, judgment calls that we made wrong. Do you ever think about that? I do from time to time. But I remember now something that James Dobson said about this. He has a lot of wisdom. He said, you know, if your kids know that you love them, you can make mistakes and it'll turn out okay anyway. If under it all, they know that you love them. And I think our kids did. I think they knew that we loved them. And if we make some mistakes, what does 1 Peter 5:8 say? Love covers a multitude of sins. And I think that applies in this case. We just, if our kids know that we love them, then we do our best. And, you know, if we make some mistakes, they understand. And, you know, some of those situations that every once in a while come back to mind. One time I brought up one of them, and my son didn't even remember it. Where I just thought I'd made a mistake, and I've been too demanding, and another time, just anyway. Love covers a multitude of sins. And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose. I don't ever think we should do wrong intentionally. We should do the best we can. But, you know, sometimes if we make a mistake, it might be that God had another purpose to fulfill in that child's life through our mistake and having the child learn to deal with our mistake or something like that. We don't know. And I think Romans 8:28 comes into play there. And then H, we must transfer the truth down to the generations yet to come. That is a major responsibility. Psalm 78 says, I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings from old, things that we have heard and known, that our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from our children, but tell them to the coming generation the glorious deeds of the Lord and his might and the wonders he has done. He established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers to teach their children, that the next generation might know them, the children yet unborn, and arise and tell them to their children, so that they should set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments. This is such a crucial issue then. It's our responsibility while we have children at home, and then we oftentimes have opportunity to have influence on grandchildren or even great-grandchildren. If we have Christian families in churches around the country, and those Christian families have children who are obedient and polite and disciplined and cheerful and happy and confident and peaceful, if we have children like that, if they're disciplined and taught well, they will stand out more and more as different from the non-Christian culture in which they live, filled with rebellious, angry, cruel, undisciplined children who are really ashamed to their parents rather than honoring their parents. Okay, now that's that section of the outline. Now I saw some hand. I saw Edie a few minutes ago, I think. Did I? Yes. Just a minute. We're getting our system working again, Edie. No, because it won't get on the tape. Okay. Well, Rick has the microphone, but the microphone is not. Okay, good. You're on.
Okay. I was just going to say that a large role of parenting is teaching, and often parents spend more energy correcting rather than telling children what to do.
Positively.
Positively.
So it's all don't.
Yeah.
And it should be more do, or this is what you should do, or encouraging.
Well, or even letting a child know your expectations before you go into the store.
Right.
I expect you to be quiet.
Good.
And stay with me.
Yeah.
And then if the expectations aren't met, then there's a role for discipline.
Yeah.
But I think it's important for teaching. Also, many parents are not really aware of appropriate developmental abilities.
Mm-hmm.
And studies have shown that parents tend to underestimate their infants and overestimate their toddlers.
Oh.
And so toddlers get corrected for things they're really just learning.
Aha. Okay.
So
thanks, Edie.
Those are just some thoughts.
Good. Edie is, in her wise speaking, an advertisement for the Phoenix Seminary Counseling Program. Good. Thank you. Good. You know, I'm going to say one other thing that I thought of. Sometimes, I mean, there's don't, that's the negative. There's this is what I expect of you. There's another skill in parenting, and that's just doing nothing. Letting kids be kids. And sometimes I see parents with their kids, they're just always correcting or saying, don't do this or do this. And I don't have a place to do this, but I want to say, leave them alone. They're just kids. They're just playing. They're not doing anything bad. So there's some wisdom in that too. Pammy?
Wayne, in our business, when we would interview mechanics and we had mostly blue-collar type workers, but always in the interview process, we would ask and bring it up, hey, tell me about growing up. Were you spanked as a kid?
Wow.
And it really is amazing because kids who had correct discipline with spanking, certainly not abuse or anything,
right,
had a very clear understanding of authority.
Yep.
And it was a very key question that we saw played out over and over again as adults.
See, Pammy, when you say this, I'm thinking again, when God starts out to tell people how society should work, the very first thing he says, honor your father and your mother. That's where it all starts. That's where everything starts for society to work rightly. Kids honor their father and their mother. What else? I know there's probably more comment on this. Way in the back, that's Margaret Solberg. Hold on. I'm getting a lot of moms commenting today. Margaret, you are as very far away from Pammy as anybody could be in this whole room, so the microphone is coming. All right.
Thank you. I wanted to comment on, you had kind of used the word spanking and discipline interchangeably.
Yep.
I train foster parents to become foster parents.
Ah,
it's against the law for foster parents to spank children who come into their home. These are children who've been abused, and so spanking is a whole different realm, and they have a different relationship.
Wow.
So part of the training is teaching them how to discipline children without using physical punishment.
Yep.
And so I think there's a big difference between not spanking a child and not disciplining a child.
Okay.
It's very important for children to be disciplined, but it's possible. Many good parents do a good job raising their children without using physical discipline.
Okay.
I mean, without using physical punishment. Punishment is to cause pain.
Yep.
The word discipline comes from teach. To discipline is to teach, and we want to teach children to control their emotions and control their actions and to obey.
Yep.
But it doesn't have to be through physical discipline, through physical punishment. So I just want to point out there's a difference between spanking and disciplining.
Yeah, okay. So, Margaret, thank you. And I think, what are some other examples of discipline without spanking? It's withdrawal of privileges, a timeout, go to your room, no TV, no cell phone.
Consequences, logical consequences.
Yeah, a lot of other things.
Removing
privileges.
Having a sit-down chat with the child and talking about what you expect, like you were saying.
Okay.
Make sure they understand expectations.
Okay.
And make sure they understand why we don't want them to
do
what. So, and that's one of the things we teach, because we have families that come in that have their own children and they discipline their children through spanking.
Yeah.
And so we need them to have a new mindset.
Yeah. Okay.
And they come back later and they tell me, wow, it's really working great and I'm doing it with my own kids.
I'm going to go, Margaret, I'm going to respond to that. On the one hand, I would say to parents in the state of Arizona who are accepting foster care, if the rules are you can't spank and you're willing to work within that rule, then follow the rule. You have to do that. You voluntarily submit to it. So I don't want to disagree with that. I don't think you should say, I'm going to submit to this and then secretly disobey it. That's not right. But I'm going to come back and say, I don't like the rule. Because I believe the book of Proverbs, where it says, whoever spares the rod hates his son, and folly is bound up in the heart of the child, but the rod of discipline drives it far from him.
But we're talking about spanking a child that you haven't raised. You don't have a relationship.
Yep.
That child doesn't know you. They don't trust you. They don't love you.
Yep.
And so it's totally different spanking a child who's been in my home for 2 weeks as opposed to spanking a child that I nursed, I raised, I cuddled, I held, and I built that love relationship with. You don't spank a one-month-old baby for crying.
Of course.
So you don't spank your children until you've established that relationship.
Okay.
But a foster parent brings that child into the home. They don't have that love relationship.
Okay, I can hear the arguments. I'm not 100% persuaded yet, but you know, there's room to disagree on it, and I can understand it's a very different situation. I can understand that too, and I appreciate what you say. So thank you. Good. What else? Over in the middle here, and then E.G. up. Tell me your name.
Bill.
Bill, okay. There's a microphone over here.
We have a grandson who, 13.
Yep.
He's dyslexic, very.
Yep.
He's ADHD, very. He has learning differences.
Yep.
He can't really function in a private Christian school.
Yeah.
They've tried that. He can't function well in public school. The attempts at remedial education are not either proper or substantial. He's in a special school for children like this.
Yep.
And he resists all kinds of correction. He doesn't understand many consequences and forgets instructions that he was told yesterday.
Yep.
And most of them for his own good and safety.
Yep.
These are very difficult, I would call it abnormal or out of the mainstream type of situations.
Yeah.
It does cause frustration.
Yeah. Bill, I can't respond to that. Just say thank you for mentioning that. And what you're saying is that there are unusual and very difficult situations where a lot of wisdom is needed and a lot of prayer to know what to do. And I can't, without knowing in detail, I can't respond any more than that. But thank you for bringing up the fact that there are such difficult situations. Yeah. E.G., up in front here, had a comment.
When you ask if how many got spanked, and I said they didn't remember, I really don't remember getting spanking.
Okay.
My point is there's a great deal of difference in children. And the discipline I remember was I had to stay in the yard.
Ah.
My mother would tell me, you can't go out of the yard because you've done such and such.
Yep.
Well, I didn't go out of the yard, and she wasn't around. She worked.
Yeah.
And that worked on me.
Wow. Okay.
So kids are different.
And it was effective. Yeah. Okay. Good. Okay, so I don't see any other comments. So I'm going to go on, but I...
I got seven minutes, but...
Okay, well, I'm going to start and see what we can do. This is on public schooling, homeschooling, Christian schooling. This is under the general category of parenting. The fifth commandment, honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land the Lord your God is giving you. And the question comes up, what kind of school is best for children, public school or Christian school or homeschool? I've got three sections here, arguments for sending children to a public school, and then a Christian school, and then homeschooling. And I'm going to sort of try to give my best arguments for each one of these. And I could say that when our kids were growing up, let's see, when our oldest son was maybe in third or fourth grade, we worked with some other parents in the Deerfield, Lincolnshire, Northbrook, Illinois area to start a Christian school. And I was the first president of the board of that Christian school from 1982 to 1984 when it opened. And it took huge amounts of time and effort, starting from nothing in an area that had a very, very high educational standard in the public schools. But it started with 59 students from kindergarten to sixth grade. It grew to eighth grade, and now it's adding a high school. Margaret and I went back and spoke at the 25th anniversary of that school back in Northbrook, Illinois, or Northfield, Illinois, just a little over a year ago. And I told them I would be happy to come back and speak at their 50th anniversary, too, if they wanted to invite me. So it has, I don't know, what, 400 or 500 maybe? It's several hundred students now, and the Lord is blessing it. So we started a Christian school and sent our kids to a Christian school at one point in our lives. But then when they got to high school age, there wasn't a Christian school in any reasonable distance from us, and we sent them to public high school. And they had a very good experience in public high school, as well as a very good experience in a Christian high school. So that's kind of fair disclosure. That's our own background. We did not homeschool, but we know others who have homeschooled, and it has also turned out very well. And if you want to peek, well... If you want to peek at the conclusion, because Jack is going to tell me my time is up pretty soon, my conclusion is 4B on the bottom of the outline. What is best for each family will differ according to the personality and needs of the child, the abilities and interests of the parents, what kinds of Christian schools and public schools are available, and the age and interests of the child. So that's going to be my conclusion. But let's start out with arguments for sending children to a public school. Those who say that Christian parents should send their children to a public school will say, point A, the children and the parents, through parent-teacher associations and things, can have a positive influence on a public school. Jesus said, "You are the salt of the earth, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored?" And then a little later, "You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden." And then John 17, "I do not ask that you take them out of the world, but that you keep them from the evil one." And then verse 18, "As you sent me into the world, so I have sent them into the world." And though there are restrictions to some extent in public schools on what both teachers and parents and children can do and say, still, there are many opportunities to express Christian beliefs and bring the Bible and Christianity into the curriculum. And didn't Arizona just pass a law this past month, about authorizing the teaching of Bible as a literature and history course as an elective? I saw it was being considered. I think it passed. So there are still many opportunities in that area, in that way. And... I remember speaking at a church in Alabama, a big Baptist church once, and the pastor told me, the public schools here are so filled with members of our church and members of other Bible-believing churches that there isn't much call for Christian schools because our public schools basically are are Christian schools because of the strong influence of all the Bible believers in it. And I was kind of surprised to see that, but I was happy for that because there are those opportunities. Point B, another argument is there's a better educational quality sometimes. C, stronger faith and moral character developed through opposition, like Joseph in Egypt or Daniel in Babylon, where they grew strong in their faith. And I could say on colleges, our oldest son Elliot went to Miami University in Ohio, which is a secular school, and did very well. And I think his faith grew and was strengthened there, especially because of association with the Campus Crusade for Christ group in a secular campus. But our younger two, Oliver and Alexander, went to Bethel College, a Christian college in St. Paul, and that was a good experience for them too. And so it differed, and those were their choices, and so I can see that both ways. Point D, there's a positive moral influence that children can have in many schools. And point E would point to inadequacies in some Christian schools. Either there isn't a Christian school, or a family can't afford a Christian school, or there might not be high academic standards in the Christian school, or the Christian school might lack the size needed in some Christian schools. They might not have the ability to challenge excellent students in things like band and orchestra and newspaper and sport teams, debate teams, advanced math courses, advanced science and language courses, etc. And people could say, well, they know of Christian schools that have teachers and administrators who are poor role models that are arbitrary, autocratic, or dictatorial, and that some Christian schools can be overly repressive and legalistic, and the atmosphere will ultimately tempt many students to rebel against Christianity itself. So I can hear those arguments. Those are the arguments for a public school. Arguments for sending children to a Christian school would be these. And first of all, point A, all of a child's education should be Bible-centered and God-centered. We just talked about fathers bring up your children in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Someone might say this applies only to home and church, and my answer is that, my goodness, bringing up a child is done a lot by a school. It's 5 days a week for 12, 13 years of their lives. That's a big part of how a child is taught and developed. So certainly shouldn't they be brought up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord, where they learn about life and they learn about the world in a school. Deuteronomy 6 and Psalm 1 would reinforce that. Point B, education, according to the Bible, should be positive and truthful. Train up a child in the way he should go. Even when he's old, he will not depart from it. So that would be a positive emphasis of a Christian school, would be training people in the right way, training children in the right way. C, peer influence should be positive and Christ-like. Bad company ruins good morals, says 1 Corinthians 15:33. And in a school, a teacher's pattern of life should be worthy of imitation. A disciple is not above his teacher, but everyone, when he is fully trained, will be like his teacher, Luke 6:40. Objection. Some people say, well, there are Christian teachers in public schools. But a Christian school supporter would say, well, there are Christian teachers, certainly, and we're thankful for them in public schools. But the amount of freedom they have to express their Christian beliefs is very limited by the law now. And then point E, only God-centered teaching gives true wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, Psalm 111, verse 10. Okay. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And I should say, one incident in our son's life in third grade was what led to the founding of Christian Heritage Academy in Northfield, Illinois. And that is, Elliot came home. He was quite a bright student in third grade. He was doing a report on Christopher Columbus. And I said, well, Elliot, look, I have a little bit of material here on Christopher Columbus. And I got out the Encyclopedia Britannica, which I had at home, under Christopher Columbus, and he couldn't read all of it, but he could read some of it. And I said, well, look, it says right here in this paragraph, that a large part of Christopher Columbus's motivation in finding the New World was to bring the gospel of Jesus Christ to other lands. I said, why don't you put that in your report, Elliot? It's in the Encyclopedia Britannica. And he said in third grade, No, Daddy, we don't talk about that in school. I thought, wait a minute. It's fact. It's true. But it's ruled out in school. He already got the message that in the place where you learn about life and you learn about truth and you learn about facts and you learn about history and you learn about science, God has no role. Why? Because, well, I've talked about that previously, our Supreme Court taking to itself much more power than it deserved to have has ruled out free expression of religion in public squares excessively, but that's the result in a third grade class. So I thought, my goodness, he's going to be trained in this all his life? We've got to do something different. So point F, Christian schooling is the best hope of transforming society, to train up children to be the salt of the earth and the light of the world. And G, there are high academic standards in many Christian schools. So that's the argument for a Christian school. Now, three, we're going to mention arguments for homeschooling. The Bible assumes that parents are responsible to teach and train their children. You shall teach them diligently to your children and talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise. There's a parental responsibility. Fathers, bring up your children in the discipline and instruction of the Lord, a parental responsibility. And point B, the most significant learning occurs in companionship, and parents, wise parents, are the best companions for their children, especially when they are young. And C, the companions a child has, even in a Christian school, might not be the best influence. A companion of fools will suffer harm, Proverbs 13:20, and bad company ruins good morals. And a parent who believes in homeschooling will say, training in moral standards and in personal character is at least as important as academic training. And point E, homeschool children on average, this is remarkable, they do show excellent educational achievement on average. And you may see from year to year that a homeschooled child won a national spelling bee or something like that. We had, when I taught at Trinity Divinity School in Illinois, our New Testament professor, Bob Yarbrough, his son Luke was homeschooled up through, I don't know, the first 8 or 9 grades, and then went to a public high school and was very competitive in track and things. Or maybe he was homeschooled even into high school, I can't remember. And when he applied to college, he got into Princeton and got a scholarship to Princeton. And I saw him a few months ago, and he's just finishing a PhD in Arabic studies at Princeton. And he's homeschooled. So there's excellent educational achievement often. But some people will say not all parents are good teachers. And if a parent, a mom or a dad, and especially the mom, it's going to fall to the mom usually. If a mom says, you know, I just don't think I'm a good teacher, then I would not recommend homeschooling. And many advanced subjects can't be taught well by most parents. And then the answer is, well, of course, you can have cooperatives in the neighborhood that will do that. And many opportunities can be created for social interaction with other children. Now, some people say that homeschooled children tend to be quiet, suspicious, and defensive. Somebody said that. But that doesn't have to be if social interaction is encouraged in other ways. And families who do homeschooling find great joy in family interaction in the process, so it can be a very good option. My conclusion, first of all, be sure to compare apples to apples. Don't compare a good public school to a bad Christian school, etc. Compare good examples of all three types, or maybe in the area you live, just have to compare the real examples. What is best for each family will differ according to the personality and needs of the child, the abilities and interests of the parents, will differ according to what kinds of Christian schools and public schools are available, and the age and interests of the child. We know a family who had, there was a good Christian school nearby, but they had a very talented musician, a junior high student with, French horn or trumpet or trombone. And there was no opportunity at the Christian school, so they sent their child to a public school because the music program gave him opportunity to participate at a high level, and I could understand that. Point C, a great solution is promoting school choice through tuition vouchers or tax credits, as in Arizona. In a tuition voucher system is adopted more and more in other states, where for every child you have, the state gives you $5,000 or $8,000 and said you can take it to whatever school you want. Take it to a public school, take it to a private school, a charter school, a Christian school, a Jewish school, whatever you want. It's your decision. It allows freedom of choice for parents. I like that a lot. It was okayed by the Supreme Court in 2002, even for religious schools, and there in the last 2 years have been remarkable gains in many states in such school choice options in 2011 and 2012 due to majority of conservative legislators elected in many states, and I think that's a growing trend, and I'm glad to see it.
Lord, thank you. Thank you for the great joy and responsibility you give us, many of us, to be parents and to relate to children and grandchildren. Give us wisdom as we do that. Thank you for the richness of your word, on which we've only touched the surface this morning. Lord, we pray for our society that it would more and more understand the need for children to honor their father and their mother and be disciplined so that they will respect the authority of parents and turn out to be disciplined and constructive, helpful citizens in their own lives. Guide us this week and help us to walk with you and know your guidance, your wisdom. Lord, for the difficult situation of a grandchild that was mentioned here, we pray for your wisdom and your grace and your mercy and your intervention, and for other situations probably that others here in the class know. We ask for your help in those situations as well. And thank you for Margaret's work in training foster parents, Lord, and bless her and guide her and give her much wisdom in that work. Thank you for the sacrifices that she and others make in that regard. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.